Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. The United States has split with its European allies by refusing to blame Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, a dramatic shift in transatlantic relations under President Donald Trump, AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The United Nations adopts a resolution demanding Russia immediately withdraw troops from Ukraine, but it's not legally binding. It was opposed by the U.S., which had its own resolution calling for a swift end to the war, but never mentioning Russia's invasion. That resolution failed. Here's U.S. Deputy Ambassador Dorothy Shea before the General Assembly vote.
Neither these amendments nor the resolution offered by Ukraine will stop the killing.
Ukraine's Deputy Foreign Minister Mariana Betsa also spoke to the GA.
This is a moment of truth. A historic moment.
And she says her country is exercising its right to self-defense. I'm Julie Walker.
Ukraine on Monday marked 3 years since a full-scale invasion by Russia. Reuters correspondent Diane Toe has more.
As Russia's war in Ukraine entered its fourth year on Monday, the Kremlin said it welcomed what it called a new U.S. approach to dialogue with Moscow. President Trump has flipped the switch on Western efforts to isolate Moscow following the war as he and his officials engage with their Russian counterparts over plans to end it. Ukraine has said it's committed to a diplomatic resolution to the war, but with Kyiv and Europe shut out of those talks, Washington seems inclined to grant Russia a number of concessions that may be hard for Ukraine to swallow. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has told NATO allies it was unrealistic for Ukraine to join the military alliance if it wants to settle with Russia.
Reuters correspondent Diane Toe. This is VOA News. President Trump said Monday he supported an email demand sent by Elon Musk telling federal workers to list their accomplishments in the past week or be fired. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Trump, without offering any evidence, said it was necessary to find federal workers who are not working.
Others, great. Because we have people that don't show up to work and nobody even knows that they work for the government. So by asking the question, tell us what you did this week, what he's doing is saying, are you actually working? And then if you don't answer, like you're sort of semi-fired or you're fired, because a lot of people are not answering because they don't even exist. They're trying to, but that's how badly various parts of our government were run by, and especially by this last group.
The Department of Government Efficiency, led by the chainsaw-wielding billionaire, sent an email to the nation's 2.3 million civil service workers, asking them to provide a five-point summary of their work last week and respond by Monday night. Some agencies told workers to comply, while others told their workers to ignore the email. It was the first sign of internal resistance to Musk's blunt force approach to downsizing the federal government. On Monday, a group of labor unions that have asked a federal judge to stop mass firings updated their lawsuit to request that Musk's email be ruled illegal.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. Members of a mosque that burned down last month near Los Angeles are still determined to gather. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
The Masjid al-Taqwa Mosque in Altadena that was gutted in the Eaton fire is beginning to once again gather for prayer, meals, and support. Holy month of Ramadan is less than a week away. Farzana Asada Zaman is a member of the mosque and one of many who lost their home in the LA fires.
Ramadan has come to our minds, you know, it is in a couple of weeks, and we've definitely thought of where we will be spending it because Masjid al-Taqwa is no longer, right? But the people are there.
But she and others are confident that the Altadena community is resilient.
I absolutely love our communal sense, the support, the spiritual support, the emotional support, the mental support.
And even though they no longer have a physical mosque to gather, she isn't worried.
We have a very strong community.
I'm Haya Panjwani.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Kyiv. 3 years later,
even those who have experience in the 2014-2015 war in Donbas couldn't fully imagine what the situation would be like.
A strange day at the United Nations.
And they did adopt those amendments. So those were put into the U.S. draft, and in the end, the U.S. abstained on their own draft because they didn't like those amendments.
And how do Americans think President Donald Trump is handling the economy?
I just paid 20 cents more per gallon at Costco yesterday, but it doesn't matter to me because in the future I know my children will be benefiting in some way and our economy will pick up.
Today is Tuesday, February 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Monday marked the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of its neighbor, Ukraine. Since then, the brutal war has killed or wounded hundreds of thousands on both sides, has displaced millions, and left much of Ukraine in ruins, but not defeated. Russian forces have been shelling Kharkiv in northeastern Ukraine almost daily since the start of their invasion. Despite the constant bombardment, local business owners continue working, and volunteers from all over the world are on hand to offer support. Anna Kostachenko has the story.
Kharkiv native Olga Zolotnitska never left her hometown despite Russia's invasion. And her bakery, which she opened over 25 years ago, never closed. Not even in September 2022, when a missile fell just a few meters away from the store.
On February 24th at 5 a.m., I just knew what my team and I needed to do. Bake bread for the military and for the people. We worked nonstop, never pausing for a single minute.
Zolotnitska hears talk of a negotiated peace, but believes the only way to end the war is through military action.
We have only one guarantee of safety, our military. That's it.
John Vorobey, a 62-year-old volunteer from Canada of German-Ukrainian origin, came to Kharkiv in the spring of 2024 to help out.
I work in a private offsite kitchen that only cooks for the military and for a couple of hospitals where they don't have good in-house food service. Mm-hmm. We prepare meals for 800 soldiers a day and 400 hospital patients.
Vorobey served in the Canadian Army for 6 years. He believes that the presence of Allied troops in Ukraine could ensure lasting peace with Russia.
In the Second World War, when the British asked for help, 1 million out of 7 million Canadians came to Europe and the Pacific Theater to help. And we can't get 100,000 to come to Ukraine. It's kind of an embarrassment for me as a former soldier.
55-year-old Kharkiv entrepreneur and activist Dmytro Kutovy spent over 25 years in commercial real estate and founded several projects here. Since the start of Russia's invasion, Kutovy left real estate and became a coordinator for the Kharkiv Media Hub, a volunteer project supporting journalists during wartime.
A big conventional war presents unique conditions for work. Even those who have experience in the 2014-2015 war in Donbas couldn't fully imagine what the situation would be like.
In March 2022, during an artillery shelling of Kharkiv, Kutovy suffered a shrapnel injury to his back. And though the city continues to be shelled, Kutovy is determined to remain here until there is lasting peace.
For me now, no other outcome of this war, except for complete restoration of Ukrainian statehood, will be considered a victory or a satisfactory result.
Zolotnitska says despite the difficult times, she continues to believe that Ukraine has a bright future. Before they open up the bakery every morning, she gathers her team and they express their gratitude for greeting another day.
Every morning we all wake up, gather together and hold hands. It's called a circle of love. And we thank the universe for keeping us alive.
John Vorobey feels the same. He tried to join the International Legion in Ukraine, but was turned away because of his age. But he remains in the city volunteering his support to Ukraine's armed forces. Anna Kostachenko for VOA News, Kharkiv, Ukraine.
And in New York, the UN General Assembly marks the third anniversary of the invasion by narrowly approving two competing resolutions on ending the war. One, drafted by Kyiv with the European Union, which calls for peace and condemns Moscow for invading in 2022. A second resolution, written by the United States, also calls for peace, but showing President Donald Trump's changing foreign policy directives, it does not name Russia as the aggressor. For more, I'm joined by VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
So it was a very unusual situation, Steve. We had originally only one resolution coming to the UN General Assembly today, but on Friday, late Friday afternoon, the United States said that it was going to bring its own resolution, which was rather shocking in itself, because for the past 3 years, the United States and Ukraine have usually worked hand in hand on these sorts of resolutions that come to the UN General Assembly. So Ukraine had been working with the European Union for several weeks. They were pretty sure they were going to have good support. You know, it was a resolution that repeated a lot of the things we've heard over the past 3 years. It reaffirmed Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and its internationally recognized borders, all very important things. And it said that it was Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So certain things that they always sort of reiterate. But then the Americans came with their own resolution, and it was about four lines long, which is really short in UN world, and it was very brief and to the point, and it said it was called the Path to Peace, and it mourned the loss of life on both sides in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and said the UN's main purpose is to maintain international peace and security and settle disputes peacefully, and it implored a swift end to the conflict. But it did not place blame at Russia's feet for invading Ukraine, and it did not talk about Ukraine's sovereignty.
Did it mention Russian at all?
Yes, it did. It just said throughout the Russia-Ukraine conflict and urged a lasting peace between Ukraine and Russia. So it made them sort of equal, and that sort of set off alarm bells among particularly European diplomats at the United Nations, and they worked through the weekend. I heard from one diplomat this morning that any diplomat who got home last night before midnight got home early. So it was, you know, all hands on deck emergency for the Europeans. In the end, both resolutions went to the UN General Assembly. The Europeans came with three amendments trying to put in that language that's very important to them about sovereignty and territorial integrity and who started the war. Those were adopted. Those amendments were adopted by the wider membership. You had all 193 member states able to vote today. And they did adopt those amendments. So those were put into the U.S. draft. And in the end, the U.S. abstained on their own draft because they didn't like those amendments.
So both resolutions passed, but if anything, it looks like Ukraine might have lost because publicly the U.S. isn't backing them as strongly.
Absolutely. And they also lost in terms of international support because then this picked away a few states because now they were nervous to upset Washington or they were not happy with the new language or whatever it may have been. So in previous resolutions, they've had like 140 states support them, and now they had 93. Last year, they had about 99, so support had dropped. I think there's a bit of Ukraine fatigue here, especially last year during the height of the Gaza war, and there was anger among some of the Arab and Muslim countries here that Ukraine did not support Gaza in resolutions in the General Assembly. So some of those countries abstained today. So there are a lot of factors at play, but it wasn't great for Ukraine. And then in the afternoon, we had a repeat of this in the UN Security Council. The Ukrainians did not bring their resolution there, but the Americans did. And again, the Europeans came with these amendments, and they failed in the Security Council to be adopted. They passed in the General Assembly, but they failed in the Security Council. So it was just the short four-line American draft that was adopted, and it was adopted. And in a way, shockingly, because Britain and France and the Europeans have said from the beginning of this conflict, for 3 years, we have heard that the Ukraine war is an existential threat to Europe. And Britain and France could have used their veto today to put down this American resolution, which they felt was woefully inadequate in their eyes, but they did not.
Why do you think that is?
I think in part it's because you had President Macron at the White House today while this was all happening, and UK Prime Minister Starmer is coming later this week. I think they have their, you know, they're concerned about rocking the boat with the Trump administration right now, right out of the gate. So it got adopted in the council, and they abstained. The British and the French abstained. The other thing is, to be fair to them, they don't use their vetoes. They haven't used their vetoes in 35 years, the British and the French. The last time they used it was about Panama. But you'd think if something is an existential threat to your country and you felt very strongly about it, you would use your veto.
And we'll leave it there for today. Margaret Bashir, VOA's UN correspondent in New York. Margaret, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Steve.
Despite some turmoil between the two countries in the UN, France's president, Emmanuel Macron, is in Washington visiting with Trump. Macron says he'll appeal to Trump's image of himself as a strong leader to press Europe's case for supporting Ukraine as they meet Monday at the White House to discuss ties between the age-old allies. Anita Powell reports from the White House.
A quick bienvenue, then straight down to business for France's president at this high-stakes White House meeting on bringing the war in Ukraine to an end. President Donald Trump pushed his desire for a deal to end the war, which on Monday struck its grim third anniversary. He has said this will include an agreement with Ukraine for its critical minerals, a deal he hinted could be signed as soon as next week by Ukraine's president.
There's tremendous distrust on both sides. That's why it's good that I'm coming in now, but I think it's to the very much benefit of Russia to make a deal and to go on with leading Russia in a very positive way. That's what you have to do. But I really believe that he wants to make a deal. Maybe wrong, but I believe he wants to make a deal.
French President Emmanuel Macron was more circumspect, correcting Trump in the Oval Office when he said Europe supported Ukraine with a loan, and then giving this warning about trusting Moscow.
My strong point was to say, let's try to get something first which can be assessed, checked and verified. And let's be sure that we build sufficient guarantees on the short run. And this is where we are ready to be engaged. As for France, a lot of my European colleagues are ready to be engaged. But we do need this American backup because this is part of the credibility of the security guarantees. And this is our collective deterrence capacity. And I have the feeling that the president has this capacity.
And we spoke of what the two leaders actually accomplished in their meetings. William Pomerantz is a senior fellow at the Wilson Center.
It looks like they agreed to have European peacekeepers enforce the peace between Russia and Ukraine. There are a lot of other side issues that I haven't really been able to get a hold of. But yes, there's attempts to have a peace agreement and a use of peacekeepers to enforce the agreement between Russia and Ukraine.
Ukraine's president expressed hope and emphasized the importance of Washington's role.
Our teams are already working productively with the U.S. on economic agreement, which we hope to sign in Washington. And President Trump, we would really like to hear from you because all our people, all our families are very worried. Will there be support from America? Will America be the leader of the free world? And I want to be very honest with you. For our people, for life in general, it's so important that American support, American assistance remains.
But other world leaders expressed concerns that Ukraine was kept out of high-level discussions in Saudi Arabia between Washington and Moscow. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Apart from the Istanbul process, Russia has been excluded from the tables established so far, and therefore the desired result has not been achieved. If results are to be obtained from the new process, Ukraine must definitely be included in the process, and this war must be ended through mutual negotiations.
Russia's leader said that so far, talks have not been specific. Russian President Vladimir Putin.
During the phone conversation and the meeting in Riyadh, we certainly touched on issues related to the Ukrainian crisis. However, it was not discussed in essence. We only agreed that we would approach it. That being said, of course, we are not rejecting the participation of European countries.
Meanwhile, in Europe, Ukraine somberly marked Monday as the third anniversary of this brutal war. Paris's most famous icon, the Eiffel Tower, burned bright. the colors of the Ukrainian flag. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Pope Francis remains in critical condition, but did show slight improvement in laboratory tests and resumed some work activities. The Vatican's evening bulletin was more upbeat than in recent days as the 88-year-old Francis battles pneumonia in both lungs. The Vatican said he hadn't had any more respiratory crises since Saturday and that the kidney insufficiency detected on Sunday was not causing alarm at the moment. According to doctors, his prognosis, though, still remains guarded. Germany's likely next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, will start trying to form a coalition government on Monday after his conservative bloc won a national election that saw far-right and far-left parties each gain support from disaffected voters. Merz, who has no previous experience in office, is set to take charge with Europe's largest economy ailing, its society split over migration, and its security caught between a confrontational U.S. and an assertive Russia and China. The Taliban continues to administer hardline corporal punishment. Afghanistan's Taliban authorities publicly flogged 20 men and women Monday on charges of adultery, rape, and engaging in what they called illegitimate relations. The Taliban Supreme Court reported that all defendants received the sentences of 39 lashes each and prison terms ranging from 1 to 7 years. The punishments were carried out in the eastern coast and central Parwan provinces. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. We'll have more on the M23 rebel group in eastern Congo coming up. But now, American politics and the American economy. Immigration and the economy were among U.S. voters' priorities when they went to the polls in November. But how do Americans feel about the economy now, a month into Trump's presidency? VOA's Veronica Baldaris Iglesias spoke to people in the nation's capital with Genia Dulu, contributing from California.
U.S. inflation rose 3% in January. But several supporters of President Donald Trump in Simi Valley, California, are confident his administration will eventually get it under control. Trump supporter Jeff Merlis.
There's a reason that some prices are up, and a lot of the prices may never come back, but they won't keep going up once we fix the economy.
Rebecca Yucino is also a Trump supporter.
I just paid 20 cents more per gallon at Costco yesterday, but it doesn't matter to me because in the future I know my children will be benefiting in some way and our economy will pick up.
Owen Lee, who owns an auto center in Falls Church, Virginia, voted Democrat in the presidential election. He's already seeing a decrease in customers who are hesitant to spend money on car repairs. If tariffs are imposed on spare parts, he says he'll need to pass some of those extra costs onto his clientele.
I'm not to buy part direct from the Canada or Mexico or China. We have a middleman. When they charge me more money, then we have to increase the price. Otherwise, I cannot run the business.
D.C. restaurant and lounge owner Douglas Crocker voted Democrat, too, in the presidential election. He's also making business adjustments in light of rising inflation.
We've dealt with a number of different wholesale buyers, and we've found ourselves now having to make sure we're budgeting and watching what the being price conscious about our price purchases.
Constantine Stavropoulos owns a diner in the U.S. Capitol. Tariffs on ingredients such as Mexican avocados could force him to increase the prices of certain dishes. Although he didn't vote for Trump, he's optimistic some policies the president has proposed will move the economy in the right direction.
My only hope is that he follows through on the tips not being taxed for employees, for tipped employees. That would be a big boom for that would help us in the restaurant industry.
He'd also like to see the Trump administration bring the cost of energy down, which Stavropoulos notes impacts truck deliveries of produce. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump's moves to reshape, shrink, streamline, and in some cases reorient the U.S. government are well known. This past weekend, he fired the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, other top generals, and importantly, several of the military's top lawyers. Critics say he's gone too far. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has brushed aside concerns that President Donald Trump's firing of the top U.S. military officer, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General C.Q. Brown, could be seen as injecting politics into the military. Hegseth spoke to the cable news show Fox News Sunday.
This is a reflection of the president wanting the right people around him to execute the national security approach we want to take. And I have a lot of respect for C.Q. Brown. I got to know him over the course of a month. He's an honorable man, not the right man for the moment.
Trump vowed on the campaign trail to wipe out what he called woke ideologies from the military and swiftly dismiss many top leaders. A goal shared by Hegseth in a podcast prior to his nomination for Secretary of Defense.
Well, first of all, you got to fire, you got to fire the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
In 2022, when Brown was the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, he and his civilian counterpart under the Biden administration issued a memo calling for Air Force officer recruitment goals based on race and sex in an effort to achieve a force the memo said would be, quote, more representative of the United States. Luis Caldera served as Secretary of the Army during the Obama administration.
Punishing senior military leaders because they were appointed in the previous administration or carried out the policies of the previous administration, just as they would expect them to carry out the policies of this administration, is just wrong.
In addition to Brown's firing, Hegseth removed Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Lisa Franchetti, Air Force Vice Chief of Staff General Jem Slife, and the Judge Advocates General, or JAGS, for the Army, Navy, and Air Force.
It's not lost on anyone that they have removed the only African-American and the only woman who served on the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Hegseth has made lethality the top priority of the force, saying the military's strength is not in its diversity, but in its unity.
Our strength is our shared purpose, regardless of our background, regardless of how we grew up, regardless of our gender, regardless of our race.
Hegseth travels Tuesday to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to get a firsthand look at the U.S. military facilities holding undocumented migrants. The Department of Homeland Security is holding 17 immigration detainees in military facilities there. The Trump administration has detained dozens of other migrants at Guantanamo before deporting them. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
And finally tonight, we've been reporting here on the violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo between the Congolese military and the M23 rebel group. On Monday, the DRC's prime minister addressed the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Reuters' Alice Rizzo reports.
Fighting in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has killed some 7,000 people since January, according to Judith Suminwa-Tuluka, the country's prime minister. She spoke at a high-level meeting of the Human Rights Council in Geneva on Monday.
The destruction of more than 90 camps for internally displaced people, attacks on hospitals and humanitarian warehouses. According to the UN, more than 450,000 people are without shelter, food and water.
Since January, the M23 rebel group has captured swathes of eastern Congo, including the cities of Goma and Bukavu. The conflict over power, identity and resources dates back to the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s. But the latest fighting and M23's advances mark a major escalation in eastern Congo. Suminwa urged the world to act and impose sanctions on Rwanda.
We call on the international community to strengthen its humanitarian support, to provide resources to take care of thousands of wounded and displaced people, and to ensure that international humanitarian law is respected, as its principle is essential to save lives and ease the suffering of Congolese people.
About 40,000 people have fled to Burundi in 2 weeks to escape the fighting, the UN reported on Friday. Burundi is one of the 9 countries bordering the DRC. Suminwa warned that the worsening security situation with M23 and other armed groups could spill over into neighboring countries and pose a danger to them.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us today, and that's going to wrap it up for us. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Carrick.